This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. There have been some astonishing revelations about the behaviour of then-US President Donald Trump on the day of the US Capitol building riot. The January the 6th inquiries heard he demanded to be driven to the Capitol, and when rebuffed, he tried to grab the steering wheel of his presidential limousine and lunged at his security detail. Is North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
Cassidy Hutchinson is a former aide to the chief of staff to then President Trump. She recounted how Donald Trump became increasingly furious that some of his armed supporters weren't being let into the rally outside the White House on January 6th, 2020.
Take the effing mags away. They're not here to hurt me. Let them in. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol after the rally's over. They can march from the ellipse. Take the effing mags away. Then they can march to the Capitol.
Mags refers to magnometers, which were being used to screen the crowd for weapons. Some of Cassidy Hutchinson's video testimony has been played at previous public hearings, but today she provided extraordinary and startling details of just how close Donald Trump came to joining his supporters as they rioted at the Capitol. She recounted a dramatic altercation in the president's limousine, known as the Beast, after his security detail refused to drive him to the Capitol due to concerns about safety.
The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
Ms. Hutchinson describes a president out of control even well before January 6th. She says she witnessed the aftermath of one Trump outburst, where he threw dishes against the wall, angry his attorney general had done an interview where he said there was no evidence of widespread electoral fraud. A staff member pointed out the damage to her.
He motioned for me to come in and then pointed towards the front of the room near the fireplace mantle and the TV, where I first noticed there was ketchup dripping down the wall and there's a shattered porcelain plate on the floor. The valet had articulated that the president was extremely angry at the attorney general's AP interview and had thrown his lunch against the wall.
Ms. Hutchinson says her former direct boss, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and Rudy Giuliani, who was Trump's personal lawyer, both sought presidential pardons. She says Trump also expressed interest in granting pardons to those who had rioted at the Capitol. But those pardons were never given. This is Carrington Clark in Washington, reporting for AM.
Former socialite Ghislaine Maxwell is facing the next 2 decades in prison after being sentenced in a New York court for sex trafficking minors in partnership with financier Jeffrey Epstein. Handing down the sentence, the judge described Maxwell's conduct as heinous and predatory. North America correspondent Barbara Miller was in court.
Well, Judge Alison Nathan said that Ghislaine Maxwell had played a pivotal role in what she called a horrific scheme where she, along with her then partner, Jeffrey Epstein, recruited, abused and trafficked young girls, the youngest 14 years old. Judge Nathan said that the sex abuse had taken place by and with Epstein, that the behaviour was heinous and predatory and that she had caused long-lasting harm. And furthermore, she said that Ghislaine Maxwell was not above the law. Nobody was above the law, she said, and that this sentence should reflect that.
The court heard from Maxwell herself and from a number of her victims. What did they say?
That's right. 4 women in total addressed the court, 2 of whom had testified in the trial here late last year, 2 of whom didn't testify, weren't part of that trial, but also talked of the long-term damage they said they suffered from being associated and being abused by Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Most of the women turned at some point during their presentation to Ghislaine Maxwell, directing their emotion, their anger, their tears towards her. She at that point stared straight ahead, appearing not to acknowledge those women. She then, however, got up herself and read a prepared statement to the court. She did acknowledge the pain of the victims, but she didn't go as far as saying sorry. She said that it was the greatest regret of her life, that she had met Jeffrey Epstein, and it was really him and not her who should be before the court. We also heard outside court from Bobby Sternheim. She was the main lawyer, the lead lawyer for Ghislaine Maxwell. She had also actually addressed the court and turned directly, twisting around to talk to the victims in court, again acknowledging their pain. But outside court, she said that Ghislaine Maxwell had been made a scapegoat for the crimes of her one-time boyfriend.
Our client, Ghislaine Maxwell, has been vilified, pilloried, and it left little room for her to be treated fairly, because even before she stepped forward into this courthouse, she was being tried and convicted in the court of public opinion.
So, Barb, what now then for Ghislaine Maxwell?
Well, Ghislaine Maxwell was led away in shackles. Her feet were shackled. That's not something we saw during the trial here last year. We understand she'll go back to the Brooklyn Detention Centre, where she's been held for a couple of years. Her lawyer requested that her prison sentence be carried out in a low security facility in Connecticut. The judge asked for that request to be considered. And we also know, Sabra, that the Ghislaine Maxwell team will appeal this sentence.
That's our North America correspondent, Barbara Miller, outside the court in New York. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is hopeful a free trade deal with the European Union may be revived in coming months, arguing his stronger stance in tackling climate change and mending relations with France are both important in getting European leaders to the negotiating table. Mr. Albanese is in Spain for the NATO summit. The war in Ukraine's the main focus, with leaders trying to figure out what more can be done to force Russian President Vladimir Putin back down. Political editor Andrew Probyn filed this report from the streets of Madrid.
Anthony Albanese is quickly learning there's a lot of handshaking and posing for photos on the world stage. Meeting Spain's leader, Pedro Sanchez, who's playing host for the NATO summit, Mr. Albanese was keen to remind him there's new management in Canberra, and that means a new approach on matters such as climate change.
That was something that was having an impact on our relations with our friends.
Anthony Albanese believes there were two issues with how former Prime Minister Scott Morrison's government handled its relationship with the European community. The first was its treatment of France, when Mr. Morrison tore up the $90 billion submarine contract with French shipbuilder Naval Group, prompting French President Emmanuel Macron to label him a liar.
And the second was Australia's position on climate change.
Mr. Albanese believes a change in government will aid negotiations on a free trade agreement with the European Union, which he said had stalled, noting Pedro Sanchez was supportive of it during their meeting.
So I'm hoping for coming months to really see an acceleration. This is a market where Australia can really benefit.
While matters of trade may be on Anthony Albanese's agenda at the NATO summit, the main task for world leaders gathered in Madrid is far more pressing: how to tackle Russia, as President Vladimir Putin continues his brutal invasion of Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg saying the meeting will signal a shift in the organisation's strategy on how its members deal with matters of defence.
That will be the blueprint for NATO in a more dangerous and unpredictable world.
A Russian missile strike on a busy Ukrainian shopping centre yesterday, killing at least 18 people, proving Mr. Stoltenberg's point.
It's extremely important that we are ready to continue to provide support, because Ukraine now faces a brutality which we haven't seen in Europe since the Second World War.
And the crisis caused by Russia has resulted in NATO's ranks swelling. Sweden and Finland, traditionally neutral countries, are set to join the security alliance at the summit after Turkey threw its support behind their bid. The French President Emmanuel Macron insisting global sanctions against the Kremlin will continue as long as is necessary.
It's not the West against the rest of the world, but the camp of peace against the camp of war. Russia cannot and should not win.
If European leaders do hold firm on Russia, which is a very significant energy supplier, there'll be the need for resource-rich countries like Australia to step up. Opportunity in crisis. From Madrid, this is Andrew Probyn reporting for AM.
Rising property prices, skyrocketing rents and a lack of affordable housing have all been problems for some time. And the latest census data also shows there were more than 1 million vacant properties last year. Now another report's found there's been barely any increase in the amount of social housing, as David Sparks reports.
Winter in Hobart can be bitterly cold, and some people who can't find anywhere affordable to live are even camping at the Hobart showgrounds.
It's been an ongoing issue now for a few years, but I've definitely seen an increase in presentations of homeless people in the last month or so.
Scott Gadd is Chief Executive Officer of the Royal Agricultural Society of Tasmania, which runs the showgrounds.
I reckon I've got probably over a dozen, half of them probably in caravans that they've either begged, borrowed or stole. And quite a few in tents, which is really worrying because our site is not conducive to tents.
Mm.
It's very windy and gets very wet and they don't last very long.
He says people are there because of Hobart's housing crisis.
A lot of them are working. They just cannot get into the rental market. Rents here have gone through the roof. They're exponentially high and they're beyond what most people can afford. They're faced with the choice of, you know, rent or food, and obviously you've got to eat. So that's pretty much the issue.
Social housing is supposed to provide a safety net and it accommodates more than 700,000 people. But a new report from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows that at the end of June last year, there were just over 440,000 social housing dwellings, which is just 1% more than 12 months earlier. And as a proportion of total housing, it's shrunk over the past decade. Kate Colvin is a spokesperson for the campaign group Everybody's Home.
Oh, look, the supply of social housing is absolutely inadequate. I mean, the research shows that there's a shortfall of social housing of more than 433,000 properties. And in a practical sense, what that means is that when people get squeezed out of the private rental market and think, oh, maybe I could live in social housing, you know, they might be on a wait list for 10 years to actually get into a property. And in of course, in that time, they have to have somewhere to live and often end up homeless.
Kate Colvin says government investment in social housing hasn't kept pace with population growth.
I think the proportion of social housing has actually declined. So it's getting tougher for people to get into social housing right when they need it the most.
The Albanese government is promising to build 30,000 social and affordable housing properties in the next 5 years. Wendy Hayhurst from the Community Housing Industry Association says it's a good start, but what's really needed is a strategy that encourages private investors to put their money into long-term social housing.
Because the investors won't, you know, they won't swap investing in roads or rail or the other big infrastructure projects to invest in social and affordable housing, which they don't know whether they're going to end up with a stranded asset because it's just a one-off program. So we just need that confidence going forward.
That's Wendy Hayhurst, and she's from the Community Housing Industry Association, and our reporter, David Sparks. New research has found women are around 50% more likely to develop long COVID compared with men. Researchers are hoping it'll help them understand more about the condition, which is where a patient experiences symptoms more than 4 weeks after their infection. Here's National Medical Reporter Sophie Scott.
When Michelle Answorth took long service leave from her job as a disability support worker, she and her partner set sail from North Queensland to their home in regional Victoria, venturing ashore whenever they felt like exploring the mainland.
So we'd travel in the little mini boat to the land, get on the bikes, ride them around, walk for kilometres. Yeah, I just, that was the lifestyle I was living.
The 54-year-old was active and happy.
My physical self had never been an impediment to doing what I've wanted to do until now.
Soon after returning home for Christmas, Michelle got COVID and has since developed long COVID. For her, that's meant severe nerve pain and reduced mobility in her arms and an inability to work.
I don't know how, you know, people who are working as well as experiencing this, it must be insanely difficult.
New UK research published in the journal Nature Communications overnight shows that while long COVID is more common in those with poorer health before the pandemic and those aged between 50 and 60, a person's sex was a contributing factor, Dr. Ellen Thompson is one of the report authors.
Women were around 50% more likely to experience symptoms for 4 or more weeks than men.
To get the findings, her team reviewed health surveys of around 7,000 patients and also examined the electronic health records of more than 1 million COVID-positive people, all in the UK. Dr. Thompson hopes the findings can help scientists understand more about the illness and give policymakers a better idea of where resources are needed.
We hope that this, alongside all the evidence that's coming out around risk and around frequency of long COVID, will hopefully help policymakers and practitioners think about mitigation and prevention strategies for people who might be at higher risk, and also think about their interventions or the way they treat long COVID might impact people differently along the way.
Dr. Kirsty Short is a virologist with the University of Queensland who's also studying long COVID. She wasn't involved in this study but has reviewed the findings.
There is going to be a burden of disease from long COVID. Now, how significant that burden will be, what that will mean in terms of people getting back into the workforce, in terms of what that will mean on our healthcare system, we don't really know. But I think what's really key is we need to have a better understanding of long COVID. We need to understand what causes it, who is at risk, how do we diagnose these individuals, and most importantly, how do we treat these individuals?
University of Queensland's Dr. Kirsty Short, ending that report from Sophie Scott and Penny Timms. When mining companies and farmers want to revegetate land or take part in carbon farming projects, they look for native tree seeds or seedlings to plant. Demand has been increasing in recent years, so Aboriginal farmers in Western Australia are hoping they can boost supplies to help meet it, as Angus McIntosh reports.
2 years ago, this native tree nursery northeast of Perth was bought by the Noongar Land Enterprise Group, a West Australian collective of Aboriginal farmers.
So this is one of the main species we grow, is Acacia cuminata, or mungart in the Noongar language. A very important tree, it's actually a totem.
Production manager David Collins says demand for species including winter wattle and old man saltbush is so great, the Bullaburnup nursery can't keep up.
This year we actually planted 1 million cells. We're looking in the following years to bump that up to at least 2.5-3 million.
A 2020 report into Australia's native seed industry found a serious shortfall in the supply of native seeds for revegetation projects nationwide. Report author and Macquarie University researcher Dr. Nola Hancock says that's partly because of problems with harvesting seeds in the wild.
Climate change is having a big effect on the market. There's predictions that the quality and the quantity will be down. We have seen that over here on the East Coast when the 2019 drought was on. It was quite difficult to get seed for a lot of species.
The Noongar Land Enterprise Group is trying to change that. Group director and Ballardong Noongar man Oral Maguire runs a native seed farm in Beverley, southeast of Perth.
What we want to provide is an example of a food production and a farming model that sits in between regenerative ag and traditional land management. Aboriginal people on their traditional lands should be given the opportunity to not only participate but to lead this restoration industry.
He estimates only half of the demand for native seed is being met. Noongar Land Enterprise Group CEO Alan Beattie says more smaller nurseries would help keep jobs local and ensure revegetation projects succeed.
The vision is to be doing the seed collection, the propagation, the planting, the ongoing maintenance, so all aspects of the entire supply chain. I would expect within a couple of years' time that we'll be needing 300-plus people in order to be able to meet those demands and those services, which is will provide significant employment opportunities for Aboriginal people right across Noongar country.
Looming over every project is the challenge of climate change. But Dr. Nola Hancock says there are some techniques that could be used to grapple with rising temperatures.
Kind of like a bet hedging strategy. You've got to try and plan for now and for hundreds of years time. So you might go to a town or a region where it's 2 degrees warmer and get some seed from there. You might go somewhere where it's 1 degree warmer and get a little bit from there as well. Get more genetic diversity, get some seed in there that's already adapted to the future.
That's Dr. Nola Hancock from Macquarie University, ending that report from Angus McIntosh.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.